Hey, what's cracking? We have been working our way through John's Gospel for the last few weeks. Now, if you need an analog Bible to help you do that, put your hands up and someone's going to come around and distribute them. If you don't trust yourself with your digital Bible, because you know that it's kind of a case of straddling the Bible and Facebook, then you're telling the truth, and you also need an analog Bible. If you think you can manage, you can't. It just doesn't happen. If you're anything like me, I came to faith in an environment where they told different kinds of stories about faith, about Jesus. And the story that I was involved in when I first sort of realized that Jesus was someone more than just a story in a book, what they would say is they said, when you come to the front of the church and put your hand up and accept Jesus as your Lord and Savior, you're turning your back on a life without Him. And that life is dark and horrible and evil. And once you've accepted Him into your heart as your personal Lord and Savior, everything gets better because you've got Jesus by your side. Now, this is a really attractive message, and I was extremely excited to partake. But like many of you, I went through the process and put my hand up, had this experience, genuine experience with God, came down the front, had people pray for me, got told that I was now officially a Christian, even though I'd been a Catholic for my entire life. And I was waiting for that moment where everything was going to get good. Anyone been there? Now, I had a great childhood, wonderful upbringing, and so when I look back, nothing was really bad. I was just waiting for it to get better. But what I actually found was the opposite ended up happening. Everything got worse, and I couldn't really figure out why, because it seemed to go completely against the story that had been presented to me. And in fact, as I tried to sort of upskill in my evangelistic techniques, they would tell me the same thing. This is actually how you get people to come to faith, is you tell them that their life is terrible without Jesus, and then once they've accepted it, Him, that everything's going to get better. And it's a great marketing tactic. The problem is it doesn't really work like that. I often felt like Paul in Romans 7, because what he says is, the moment I really realized what this meant, everything started to go wrong, because I realized that even the things in my life that I thought were good were nothing in comparison to what He's called us into. So the reality is sometimes coming to faith is not as easy as we want it to be. The substance of a life committed to Jesus is actually quite difficult, quite challenging, quite overwhelming sometimes. And after, that experience for me was about 12 years ago now. And it was extremely disruptive at the beginning, but now I'm really grateful that I get to be a part of a faith that I do not understand, and that constantly challenges me, constantly overwhelms me, and fills me with a sense of, I have no idea what to do or what's going to happen next. So for the last few weeks, we've been working through John's Gospel, and John's Gospel is organized around 7 particular signs. And it's important for us to actually grasp what these signs mean, because we have a tendency to get overwhelmed as Christians by the miraculous. Now, miracles are super cool, okay? And there are miracles all the way through the Gospels, but there's a difference between a miracle and a sign. See, a miracle is something that happens that is powerful and transforming. Maybe someone's arm grows back, maybe someone raises from the dead. Super cool. But a sign might be miraculous, but it's not the miraculous that's the point. It's pointing us to something else. Does that make sense? And so all the way through John's Gospels, we have these signs where things that are incredible happen. But if you get lost in the miraculous, you'll actually miss what it's pointing to. It's like looking at a sign. I see the sign every time I drive home, the sign to Joondalup. It's like looking at the sign that says Joondalup, 55 kilometers away, and being, I'm in Joondalup, right? It's like looking at a sign, standing next to it, and thinking you've arrived. It's what we often do in John's Gospel. We see some of these incredible stories. 5 loaves and 2 fishes feeding 20,000 people. That's pretty cool. We're like, God is so good. And we see dead people literally coming out of the tomb, and we're like, whoa. It's kind of like the mummy, but it's still cool. I still get it. We see people being healed of demonic possession and lifetime sicknesses, and we go, that is incredible, and it is incredible. But in John's gospel, it's deeper than just looking at what's happened and going, that's cool. It's pointing us to something else. And the question we have to ask is, what is it pointing us to? So in the first week, Phil talked to us about the wedding at Cana, water to wine. That's definitely one where you have to go, this has got to be something else. Otherwise, Jesus is, he's just promoting sin. And then the second week, we had looked at the healing of the official's son. Again, really great moment, but what else is happening? And this week, we're going to have a look at another incredible story, another incredible healing. And we're going to ask that question, what is it pointing us to? Because I think a lot of the time in life and in faith, we get distracted by things that are easier for us to understand. And the big statement there is that it's easier for us to understand in the Gospel of John that dead people come to life than what he's actually calling us into. It's easier, it's cheaper, and it's less confronting, I think, than actually opening up our hearts and lives to the call that he's bringing. So let's read in John chapter 5. We're going to start from the beginning. So if you have your analogs with you, otherwise just unlock it and let's get going. John 5. Sometime later, Jesus went up to Jerusalem. That's it. For one of the Jewish festivals. Now, there is in Jerusalem near the Sheep Gate a pool, which in Aramaic is called Bethesda, and which is surrounded by five colored colonnades. Here, a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. One who was there had been an invalid for 38 years. When Jesus saw him lying there and learned that he had been in this condition for a long time, he asked him, "Do you want to get well?" "Sir," the invalid replied, "I have no one to help me into the pool when the water is stirred. While I'm trying to get in, somebody else goes down ahead of me." And Jesus said to him, "Get up, pick up your mat and walk." At once the man was cured. He picked up his mat and he walked. The day on which this took place was the Sabbath, and so the Jewish leaders and the man who had been healed said, "This is the Sabbath. The law forbids you to carry your mat." Like, that's the biggest thing going on, right? Some people, honestly. But he replied, "The man who made me well said to me, 'Pick up your mat and walk.'" So they asked him, "Who is this fellow who told you to pick up your mat and walk?" The man who was healed had no idea who it was, for Jesus had slipped away into the crowd that was there. But later, Jesus found him at the temple and said to him, "See, you are well again. Stop sinning or something worse will happen to you." I don't even know what that means. The man went away and told the Jewish leader that it was Jesus who had made him well. So because Jesus was doing all of these things on the Sabbath, the Jewish leaders began to persecute him. In his defense, Jesus said to them, "My Father is always at work to this very day, and I too am working." For this reason, they tried all the more to kill him. Not only because he was breaking the Sabbath, but he was even calling God his Father, making him equal with God. Now, like most of the stories in most of the scriptures, this is confusing to me. I read it and there's a few really amazing things going on and then there's a few other things going on that kind of muddy the waters. I'm not quite sure what's happening. So what we're going to do is we're going to break this story in half and deal with it in separate categories. The first wave of the story is this miraculous healing that takes place. And then the second wave of the story is the fact that a certain group of people get upset that it's taken place on a particular day. And so let's have a look at the first section. I'm just going to read it again. And I want you to hear, in John's gospel, probably more than any of the other gospels, there's almost no word that is there by accident. Everything is screaming something at you. So let's listen. Sometime later, Jesus went to Jerusalem for one of the Jewish festivals. Now there in Jerusalem, near the Sheep Gate, was a pool in Aramaic is called Bethesda, which is surrounded by five colored colonnades. Here, a great number of disabled people used to lie, the blind, the lame, and the paralyzed. If you notice in your Bible, John 5, chapter 4, doesn't exist, probably. I don't know about these new ones that are being handed around. But the reason it doesn't exist is because what John 4 used to say was it described exactly what would happen at the pool. See, here at this particular pool, you had a number of different people gathered. You had the lame, the blind, the paralyzed, but you had people from within the Jewish faith, but you also had people from a whole bunch of other religions. What they believed would happen at this pool was an angel would come down from heaven, would dip its wings in the pool, stir the waters, it would start to bubble, and the first person to get in the pool after the angel had dipped its wing there would be cured. That's pretty cool. Not cool. I think it's pretty cool. They took it out because a lot of the earliest manuscripts didn't actually have that story in it. I like it because it's kind of Marvel-esque. It's kind of fun. And also it creates a sense of like intense competition. Like, it's bubbling, rah, rah, rah. And they're all invalids and cripples and blind people. So I think it was just a total chaos. It's probably not good to laugh at that, but I think there's something going on there. And so it's essential when you're reading the scriptures to go through and pick out things that don't make sense or that confuse you. Oftentimes we're intimidated by those things, but they're the very access points that enable us to step into the story and bring out the truth of the message that's actually taking place. So the first thing that I observed in the story is that all of these blind, lame, and crippled people are gathered around a magic angel pool, which I think is quite strange. You might not find it strange. The second thing that I think is interesting is that Jesus was there. Now, Jesus was not lame, crippled, or blind, and he was a Jewish male, and so to put himself in a position where he was surrounded by sick people wasn't something that you usually did as a Jewish male. If you remember reading the story of the Good Samaritan, there's a guy on the side of the road that's almost dead, and the religious leaders that walk past don't go to him, not because they're void of compassion. I mean, maybe that's part of it, but they don't go because they know that as Jewish males, particularly as priests, if they go to the sick person, touch him, get near him, they're going to be infected in some way. It's going to tarnish who they are. And so for Jesus to be in this place at the very beginning is quite a strange thing. The next thing that struck me as quite strange was verse 5. One who was there who had been an invalid for 38 years. Now this is strange because clearly it's a competitive environment. Clearly it's a strange environment. You have people from different faiths gathering together, trying to access this healing point. I imagine that it was not a really successful space either, because there's a lot of people still there. But have you ever used an excuse to get out of a party? So I'm going to use a bad analogy here, but when you have kids, it's really difficult in the beginning. But there's one outstanding bonus to it, is that you have kids. Anytime someone says, hey, come to my party, or can you, I'm like, kids, sorry. And they're like, oh, great. I understand completely. And I'm like, yeah, totally. But now that my eldest, they're sort of 5 and 4, it is starting to wane. You know, that whole, oh, kids, I can't come to church, or I can't come to your party, or I can't, you know, it's getting a little bit old. This guy has been sat by the pool for 38 years. I wonder if in 38 years, someone invites me to a party, I'm like, oh, sorry, I have kids. 38 years ago. See, there's something else going on in this story. It's unusual that he's been there for 38 years. Now, I'm going to read between the lines here, but I think that there's a difference between someone who finds himself sitting next to a pool in desperate need of healing and someone who's set up camp there for 38 years. And the reason I think this is strange is because of Jesus' question, the way that he asks the question. If you notice what Jesus says, now a lot of the time Jesus is really kind and compassionate, but the question that he asks this man is almost scathing in its tone. Do you want to be well? What's the implication? Do you even want to be healed? It's an unusual question. We would think the answer would be, of course I want to be healed. And the man gives his excuse, and his excuse is a fine one. I can't walk, and so everyone beats me to the pool. But I wonder for how long that excuse is actually valid. I wonder how long he can claim that he has been unable to access the healing moment. I wonder what's going on in that moment when Jesus is actually looking at him and going, how much do you really want to be healed? You see, there's a really interesting thing I think that happens. Because there's a difference between being paralytic, between being crippled, between struggling, and then being defined by your struggle. And see, this guy had clearly made a lifetime vocation out of being who he was and sitting where he was sitting in the place that he was sitting. He was known as the cripple that sat at Bethesda for 38 years. So there's a difference between going through something difficult and then allowing that to define who you are. Maybe some of you have experienced that in yourself. Maybe some of you have experienced it in other people. We know people Oftentimes we internalize our struggles, and that's okay for a season because we all go through difficult moments. But there's something pervasive that happens when we allow brokenness and pain and darkness to not just come into our life, but to settle there and to redefine the story of who we are. So I think in this moment, there's a challenge for this guy, faced with someone who can fulfill the very reality of what this pool is supposed to represent. And if you have struggled and allowed your struggle to define your life, or if you are sick and have allowed your sickness to define the very core of who you are, then someone coming along and offering to heal you is terrifying. Because who would you be without your struggle? Who would you be without your sickness? Who would you be without this thing that everybody knows who you are? And it's a brokenness and it's a shame, but everybody knows you by it. And it's at least a part of you, something that you can understand. What lies beyond is perhaps a sense of freedom. But freedom itself is quite unknown, I think. And so Jesus asks the pervasive question that I don't think I would ever want him to ask of me. Do you even want to be well? The guy gives him his excuse, and Jesus, I was talking with someone the other week about this particular story, and they said that the most subversive thing that Jesus could have done in this moment is to heal the man. Because now he's broken him out of a life that he has defined by his brokenness and set him into a new world. And that's a scary reality. I often hear, we are Christians and we love cliches. And there's something about a cliche that is true, isn't it? But because it's a cliche and because we say it so often, it becomes a little less true every time we say it. And oftentimes, when people are struggling, when people are hurting, I hear certain cliches come out like, oh, we're only human. Like, really? We're only human. Or, we live in a fallen world, right? We're all broken. Now, there's something at the heart of all of that I think is profoundly true. We live in a world that is broken. We have bodies that are broken, minds and souls that seem to orient towards things that are not helpful. But there is a massive difference between realizing that you are broken and settling your life in the fact that you are broken. There's a massive difference between saying we live in a fallen world and choosing to do nothing about it because it's broken anyway. Let me tell you what the difference is. The difference is those who see what's happening on Manus Island to 606 people and go, we live in a broken world. What am I supposed to do about it? Or something happens inside of us and tragedy strikes and we define our life by our tragedy and we continue to live out of that reality. See, this passage is intense, I think. Because what happens when Jesus comes into a broken world is he doesn't just leave the darkness there, is he brings light into it. And the challenge for us and the challenge all the way through John's gospel is, are you going to see the light in the middle of the darkness? The first chapter of John's gospel opens up with a beautiful story of creation, which tells you that Jesus' job is to bring a new creation into what was broken already. But the challenge in the 10th verse of the first chapter is that he came to those who were supposed to know him, but they didn't recognize him, or they didn't want to recognize him. You see, the darkness and the brokenness can be so pervasive that we don't want to see something new and something real. It's everything's broken. We're broken. Everything's fallen. We're only human. And Jesus is over here telling a completely different story. And the challenge for us is which kind of people do we want to be? Where do we want to find ourselves in this story? Do we ever want Jesus to be saying, do you really want to be well? Do you really want to participate in the world that, yes, it's broken, but I'm doing something new with it? I think when it comes to the guy who's been sat there for 38 years, and I probably sound like I have absolutely no compassion. I've never been a paralytic. But like I said at the very beginning, this story is not about a healing of one man. This story is about a healing of everything and whether we want to choose to step into that or not. And that's a difficult story. So I've been reading a book recently about which kind of focuses on the life of a guy called Elisha. And if you don't know about Elisha, he's pretty cool. He's a pretty cool guy. And Elisha had big shoes to fill because there was this prophet called Elijah. And it's easy to get mixed up. But Elijah was great. Like Elijah was the kind of guy that he could just pray and say, God, send fire down from heaven. And God would be like, yep, sure. Fire came down. Everyone was super impressed. And so to fill his shoes was a big task. But I was astounded when I started reading the story of Elisha because Elijah chooses Elisha to succeed him. And he does it in a really weird way. He kind of just walks up to him, puts his cloak on him, and then walks away. It's like implied. And what Elisha then does immediately is he goes back to his hometown, and he had all these sort of carts where they used to plow the fields and everything. He got them all together, chopped them all up, and burnt them as a symbol of, I'm going this way because I can see what's on this man and I want to follow him. And I thought that was an incredible act, and he used the fire with all the wood to cook some meat, give it out to people. So it was generous in the middle of it. But there's a particular story that I love that I think, I don't know if we're allowed to do this with the Bible, but if you place Elisha next to the guy who sat there for 38 years waiting for someone to do something for him instead, this story is quite powerful. So it's in 2 Kings chapter 2. And it said, when the Lord was about to take Elijah up to heaven in a whirlwind, Elijah and Elisha were on their way from Gilgal. Elijah said to Elisha, stay here, the Lord has sent me to Bethel. But Elisha said, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you. So he's tenacious. The company of the prophets of Bethel came out to Elisha and asked, do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today? Yes, I know, he replied, so be quiet. This guy's good. He's already got my attention. Then Elijah said to him, stay here, Elisha. The Lord has sent me to Jericho. And he replied, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you. And so they went to Jericho. The company of the prophets of Jericho went up to Elisha and asked him, do you know that the Lord is going to take your master from you today? Yes, I know, he replied. So shut up. Then Elijah said to him, stay here. The Lord, are you getting the pattern? The Lord has sent me to Jordan. And he replied, as surely as the Lord lives and as you live, I will not leave you. So the two of them walked on. 50 men from the company of the prophets went and stood at a distance facing the place where Elijah and Elisha had stopped at the Jordan. Elijah took his coat, rolled it up, and struck the water with it. The water divided to the right and to the left, and the two of them crossed over onto dry ground. When they'd crossed, Elijah said to Elisha, tell me, what can I do for you before I am taken? Let me inherit a double portion of your spirit, Elisha said. You've asked a difficult thing, Elijah said. Yet if you see me when I'm taken from you, it will be yours. Otherwise, it will not. And as they were walking along, talking together, suddenly, a chariot of fire and horses of fire appeared and separated the two of them. And Elijah was sent up to heaven in a whirlwind. Elisha saw this and cried out, my father, the chariots and horsemen of Israel. And Elisha saw him no more. Then he took up his garments and tore it in two. He picked up Elijah's coat that had fallen behind him and went back and stood on the bank of the Jordan. He took the cloak that had fallen from Elijah and he struck the water with it. Where now is the Lord, the God of Elijah, he asked. And when he struck the water, it divided to the right and to the left and he crossed over. Now there's a whole bunch of stuff going on in this story. But there's a difference between someone who's just sitting on the side waiting for something to happen and Elisha, who seems to have a tenacity about him, where Elijah is going before him and he can see that this man is following God in some crazy way. I mean, it helps that water's like parting and fire's all over the place. But when he says, you need to stay here, Elisha says, I won't stay here. I'm not going to be left behind. I can see what's going on up ahead and I'm coming with you. And everyone else goes, hey, you know, your boss is leaving. What's that? You're going to get fired. You're nothing without Elijah. He says, shut up. It'll be fine. And three times Elijah says, stay here. And three times Elisha says, not in your life. I'm going forward. You see, there's something powerful when you can see what God is doing in front of you and you refuse to stay exactly where you are. See, the life of Elisha is one of passionate commitment to what God is doing in front of him. And he seems to just burn everything behind him as he's walking forward. Maybe this is what God is inviting us into in John chapter 5. Maybe this is why Jesus says, do you actually want to be well? Or do you want to stay here being defined by what has crippled you your entire life? The second part of the story in John chapter 5 is also quite dark, really, when you think about it. I mean, on the surface, it's quite amusing. Because this guy who has not been able to walk for his entire life suddenly springs up and goes to the Pharisees. And we often forget that the Pharisees are the ones entrusted with faith. They're the pastors, the leaders, the elders, the ones who are in charge of the entire sort of spiritual fabric of the Jewish faith. They're the ones who are supposed to be able to see God at work and proclaim it to the people. But when they see a man who they know has been crippled for 38 years walking into the temple, their first question is, did this happen on the Sabbath? Why? Because for them, the Sabbath was something that was sacred and holy, and it was a day that was set apart to worship God. How outrageous then that someone could be healed on the Sabbath? I think there's a couple of things going on in this moment. I think they have misunderstood what the Sabbath is, but I also think they've misunderstood when the Sabbath is supposed to take place. See, they've misunderstood what the Sabbath was, because the Sabbath was a place, I mean, we often think of Sabbath like, I'm just gonna chill for a bit. I'm just going to sit back, have a drink, read a book, recharge my batteries. The Sabbath for the Jewish people was and still is today a time where they worship and allow God to be God. And that's an active process from God. The sense of shalom is the reality where God is actually present and the world looks, even just for a moment, how God intended it to look. And so part of Jesus' criticism of the Pharisees all the way through the Gospels, when they're criticizing him and his disciples for doing things on the Sabbath, he says, I think you've got it mixed up. You think that the Sabbath is a place where you're just supposed to worship God and God's supposed to do nothing. But when God actually moves on the Sabbath, you criticize everybody else. If you read Matthew 12, we have another unusual story about the Sabbath. It says, at that time, Jesus went through the grain fields on the Sabbath, and his disciples were hungry and began to pick some heads of grain and eat them. When the Pharisees saw this, they were always watching, they said to him, look, your disciples are doing what is unlawful on the Sabbath. Jesus answered, haven't you read what David did when he and his companions were hungry? He entered the house of God, and he and his companions ate the consecrated bread, which was not lawful for them to do, but only for the priests. Or haven't you read in the law that the priests on Sabbath duty in the temple desecrate the Sabbath and yet are innocent? I tell you that there's something greater than the temple is here. If you had known what these words mean, that I desire mercy and not sacrifice, then you would not condemn the innocent. For the Son of Man is Lord of the Sabbath. And going on from that place, he went into their synagogue, and a man with a shriveled hand was there, looking for a reason to bring charges against Jesus. They said, is it lawful to heal on the Sabbath? And he said to them, if any of you has a sheep and it falls into a pit, how will you not take hold of it and lift it out? How much more valuable is a person than a sheep? Therefore, it is lawful to do good on the Sabbath. You see, the Sabbath was a time when through worship of God, God's righteous reign was supposed to be established. And they had so missed the purpose of Sabbath that when they saw God breaking out in the form of healing and miracles, they were completely blind to it. Which is the entire theme of John's gospel. Will you see God at work when he's working? And for the Pharisees, the answer was no. They'd seen something powerful happen. And instead of reveling in the goodness of what was taking place and the kingdom that was being established, the creation that was beginning to emerge in Jesus' ministry, they tried to stone him on a technicality. How quickly something that was designed to bring life and goodness can be turned to bring oppression and slavery. How many times in our own spiritual lives do we take things that were supposed to be beautiful and use them to indict others instead? I think that's really difficult, a really difficult thing that we do. I also think that they're a little bit mixed up about when Sabbath is supposed to take place. because they don't recognize who Jesus is. So if you remember the Genesis story, there's sort of a six-day time period, right, where God is working and creating. Remember that? And then on the seventh day, once everything is done, then God says, now I will rest. And so there's other stories in the Gospels where they're criticizing Jesus for doing stuff on the Sabbath, and he says, why are you criticizing my disciples for doing this while I'm here? That makes absolutely no sense. The implication for him is, I'm actually doing something at the minute. I'm doing something creative. I'm at work bringing something new into life. So why on earth would you criticize them for violating the Sabbath? Because I'm not done creating yet. It's not surprising that John's gospel actually starts with the story of creation. In the beginning was the Word. What John's inviting you into is a brand new creation story. And so when Jesus is healing on the Sabbath, and then they're criticizing him for doing it, the implication is that the Sabbath isn't here yet. I'm still creating. I'm still doing something. I'm still working. New creation is still being established. Do you notice how many signs there are? There are seven signs. Numbers are quite significant. Because one of the questions I have to ask at the end of all of this is, what is our role? What is our place in all of this? All the way through John's gospel, Jesus is doing incredible things that are pointing us to the reality of the creation that he's bringing forward in the world. And the world that for them was defined by sickness, darkness, sinfulness, slavery, and oppression, Jesus one by one begins to dismantle them and show them a completely new world. And that reality climaxes on the cross with all of the sin, all of the evil, all of the violence projected onto him from us, but unable to win, unable to overcome it. We have these beautiful seven signs, and an author I really love put this all together really beautifully. He said there's seven signs in John's gospel. The last one is a resurrection from the dead, but Lazarus, not Jesus. But there is another miraculous thing that happens towards the end of John's gospel after Jesus has been crucified, died, and buried. He raises from the dead. It's pretty cool. But what we have in John's gospel is these seven signs positioning themselves as almost like the very first week of creation. It's a world that is broken, dark, and sinful, but God is still working in the middle of it, trying to make it better, trying to invite us into a new story. But then everything climaxes on the cross, and the moment he dies, after 3 days, he's resurrected, and the moment he's resurrected, it starts a brand new week, a brand new day. The eighth sign is the invitation to an entirely new reality, and I think it's absolutely beautiful that in John's gospel, the moment Jesus walks out of the tomb, someone comes to try and find him. They mistake him for someone, don't they? Who do they mistake him for? A gardener. Get it? A garden. There was a garden in another story, the creation story. Remember that garden? It was pretty great. So we have this first week, which is riddled with sin and darkness, oppression, opposition. And suddenly all of that is crucified. Jesus is resurrected from the dead. And the first thing that he's revealing himself as is a gardener. Someone who's bringing a new reality into being. See, this is our role in all of this. We look to the scriptures and we see that Jesus is at work. We see how they're looking at him. Some of them recognize him, some of them don't. See, our location in the story is much more challenging than theirs. Our location in the story is to look at history from this side of the resurrection, to be able to see all of the powerful stories that have happened, and to realize that what has happened is Jesus has died, has resurrected, crucified the powers of sin, and now invited us to participate in a world that is completely new. And we don't see the fullness of it, but it doesn't excuse us from committing our lives to it. Which is why I go back to my first story and realize that I wish someone had told me at the very beginning that if I put my hand up in church and responded to a message of faith, that my life wasn't going to get better, that my life was going to get more challenging because I'd have to face up to all of my own brokenness. But I wasn't allowed to stay there. that I had to face up to all of the brokenness in the world, but I couldn't just let that be. That he interrupts our apathy and he violates our ability to oppress and subvert other things. See, this is like, I don't know how I would have responded if someone had presented me with this kind of Jesus. The kind of Jesus who says, do you even want to be well? Do you even want to step into this moment? Do you even know how? See, it's one thing to experience pain, both in yourself and in the world in which we live in. And I think it's an inevitable part of being human. I think the challenge of the gospel is that it's an invitation to live as if you were part of a different world. And that means that maybe like Elisha, we need to continually, relentlessly move towards what we know God is doing. And maybe like this vision of a new created world where everything is suddenly, all the pain is suddenly gone, all the tears have been wiped away. Maybe we need to commit to a world that we know isn't like that, but really should be. And the only way it can be is if we start living that way. I'm incredibly thankful that I'm surrounded in this community by people who give us signs of hope because they live new creation lives. They refuse to be defined by their pain and brokenness, and they refuse to allow the world to define itself that way as well. You know, we heard a prayer this morning about something that's happening fairly close to home that when I really think about it, I can't believe is actually happening. I mean, it's escalated now to a point, in the beginning, it was political, maybe for a lot of us. But now it's not political. Now it's oppressive, abusive, harmful. And we need to call it for what it is. And the challenge here is, who are we going to be like? Who are we going to follow? And what world are we going to be part of creating? Are we going to allow Jesus to speak to us about new creation and what that might look like? Are we going to allow ourselves to be terrified by the unknown reality of what it would be like to be free and to live as part of a world that God wanted to create? Or are we just going to lay by the pool and say, well, look at me, I can't do anything? I'm just going to close it and pray. Lord, thank you that your scriptures invite us into intense and challenging discussions. And then we also take time to acknowledge that we experience the pain and brokenness of the world in many different ways as a community. And we know that you rest with us and speak to us in the midst of our pain and in the midst of our brokenness. You allow space to heal, to breathe, and to hear your whispers. But we also know that you are part of creating a world that is completely new, completely different, completely free. And so we confess when we have acted like the one who sits by the pool and waits for everybody else to come by and bring healing and bring life. We confess when we're like the Pharisees, when we see life breaking forth and we criticize it because it wasn't us doing it. And we humbly submit ourselves to the new world that you're creating. And we ask that you would speak through your spirit courageously into our souls and reveal to us the part that we would play in a world that's being made new. Amen.